Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 65, section 2, which is old single column, page 731. All right, so we just got into this paper in the preceding session. They gave us a little bit of preliminary material on the nature of mind. The preface was a little thumbnail sketch on some of the facts about mind. And then they gave you the section one, a little bit about life carriers. So it's a little bit about the details of what's in play, and now they're ready to give us, as they say here, this little summary, this overview, this panorama, as they call it, of the entire sweep of evolution. Again, and remember that we are most interested in thinking about what hints they're giving us about the nature of mind as it's engaged to this biologic evolutionary phenomenon. Right? How is it that what they're saying, you know, is alluding to that? They're not going to, you know, spell it out very directly. They want to they want to challenge us to see if we can recognize the basics of this over control. It's kind of interesting, you know, I pointed that out when we started the paper, you know, that fundamentally this is about the evolution from the top-down point of view, from the mindal point of view, rather than the bottom-up material or, you know, physical point of view. But they don't spoon-feed that fact to you. They basically toss out that title for the paper as a challenge for you to put those pieces together. You know, it ought to be a hint, like I said, when the preface is focusing on mind. But you know, if you're not in a mode where you're trying to challenge yourself to go beyond just reading the words as there are as they appear to you on the page, and once you read a sentence, that sentence evaporates and you're on to the next sentence. You know, if you're just in a very in the moment linear mode, at best analyzing it one sentence at a time, if you're not trying to synthesize, you know, that could just slip by you, what the really the point of the whole paper is. Okay, so you know, you know, we're going to be touching on a number of things that, you know, we certainly engaged in detail, but when we went through the previous papers, but we want, you know, we want to do our best to not just say, oh yeah, they're reminding me of that, oh, they're reminding me of that, oh, they're reminding me of that, right? And see if we can see something new. Okay.
Section 2, the evolutionary panorama. The story of man's ascent from seaweed to the lordship of earthly creation is indeed a romance of biologic struggle and mind survival. Man's primordial ancestors were literally the slime and ooze of the ocean bed and the sluggish and warm water bays and lagoons of the vast shorelines of the ancient inland seas. Those very waters in which the life carriers established the three independent life implantations on Urantia.
Okay, so when it starts out, you know, see, they are going all the way back. They're starting with algae. Right? They're starting with the initial primitive plants. And you're encouraged with the opening sentence, well, at least they called me seaweed and not pond scum. But, you know, the next sentence, there it is, the slime and ooze.
Yeah.
So it's just a one sentence, you know, a reprieve from the facts. That, you know, and remember, the evolutionary process is not just producing something in the moment, and then you build something on that foundation, and poof, that's gone. Yes, literally, that foundation, you know, might fade, but it all of the fundamental nature of what you had there gets incorporated into what follows. You know, so you know, it's not just kind of a poetic thing to say man's primordial ancestors were literally the slime and ooze. You know, you want to appreciate that your challenge to do something profoundly personal, profoundly objective, to relate, say, to the spirit of truth, is predicated on part of you literally still being pond scum, okay, which has a hard time in and of itself having much relationship to truth. You know, your feet are still firmly planted on that evolutionary starting point, and you have to challenge yourself to rise above even that. You know, and remember, it's because you still literally embody that very rudimentary vegetable foundation. That's why we're so susceptible to all these bacterial and viral assaults. Right? You know, if you were definitively up above that, that stuff would, you know, quote unquote, just pass underneath you and it wouldn't affect you. Right? But it doesn't. It in many ways hits you at eye level. You know, and can kill you. So, you know, there's a lot of consequences to this, just factually. You know, besides the sort of hard-hitting poetry of it, right, from seaweed to the lordship of earthly creation. Is there a question that someone has on the webinar? Or?
There's just one individual that
has
audio issues.
Oh, okay.
I have a question.
Oh, okay, yep.
When you said above that, you don't necessarily mean that, you know, you can become a first circular and even be in communication with thought adjuster and be above that, right? Because the physical aspects don't necessarily, or do you mean that when you say above that?
Well, I mean, in this life, perforce you serve two masters.
Yeah.
Right? Perforce. And you know, I'm just reminding you of just how down there in the literalness of the dirt that one master is. You know, I mean, the feet of clay. You know,
right.
Analogy. You know, so
that's real.
You know, it is. It's inescapable. What Jesus did was not because he didn't have to overcome that fact. Right? He was faced with the exact same fact that, you know, his ancestors were pond scum too, just like ours. You know, if his ancestors weren't pond scum, seaweed, whatever, trilobites, you know, then what he did would be of no relevance to us.
Okay. Right? And he couldn't have caught a cold.
Right. The whole point is that, you know, he had to face just what we face. And, you know, obviously, like we've said many times, you know, Gabriel didn't pick the lowliest genetics on the planet, you know, because it does have to be an individual that has the potential to challenge themselves and make it all the way. You know, he needs to complete his seventh bestowal. You know, there is that issue in play. But nonetheless, effectively, he did what all of us need to do, and showed us that you can do it. the fact that maybe one of us needs to bring in all the more definitive consecration, all the more definitive determination, is just a relativity issue. I mean, Jesus had a lot to spare, right? And you can just tap in a little bit deeper than he had to if your genetics aren't, quite as solid as his were. I mean, there's plenty of ability to do this. As long as you're normal-minded, you can do it. Just dig deeper, challenge yourself to take delight in cultivating all the more. Like I said, there was plenty in reserve when he made it to First Circler. He didn't drain the tank to get to First Circler. Okay, so the grace is that we're given is very, very generous. Right? There's plenty there. You won't come up against an empty tank, if you are earnestly consecrated to a higher end. All right, so now they're going to give a little bit more about, starting all the way with plants and getting to animals, but you'll see quickly that the main point is not to go through the whole details of what all the plants did, but to very quickly move from plants to animals, because we want to give this thumbnail sketch of getting to humans. So what else do they say here?
Very few species of the early types of marine vegetation that participated in those epical changes, which resulted in the animal-like borderland organisms, are in existence today. The sponges are the survivors of one of these early midway types, those organisms through which the gradual transition from the vegetable to the animal took place. These early transitioned forms, while not identical with modern sponges, were much like them. They were true borderline organisms, neither vegetable nor animal, but they eventually led to the development of the true animal forms of life.
Okay, so you recall, they went through all of that. You noticed that they wanted, though, to remind us that there is a definitive gradualism. And so they highlighted the word gradual there, that this is predicated on. So again, you have a foundation that is not as discreetly quantized, you might say. It's much more continuous-like, that foundation, which again, leads to a fragility, if you will, or a delicateness that you don't want to lose sight of. If you have an innate integrity that is sort of a large chunk size, little nibbles can't hurt you, right? But if you're built up gradually there in the foundation, it's like you have this very fine particulate foundation, and little things can nibble at one particle at a time away at you. It again leads to a softness of the foundation, a susceptibility to all of this assault by bacterial and viral influences. That there was this very atypical, gradually here, including all kinds is it plant, is it animal? Later in the paper, they speak to that a little bit more specifically than here, but they do mention the borderland organisms, and they were true borderline organisms. In other words, you had this, you didn't have a sharp line in the evolutionary process between, okay, this is definitively plant, boom, now this is definitively animal. It was playing in the middle a bit, And you can't help but think that that's got to be to the way they loosen things up for this experimental world, right? That it has that. But it added to this the challenging nature. Not only is your foundation all the way low, but it is like clay, very, very fine particles, right? Those feet of clay. It's not big gravel chunks and little things that can't impact it. If you reflect on this, beyond the facts that they're stating, it's like they're trying to tell you what you are, right? The truth of what you are, and they're trying to get you to reflect on that. Okay.
No, you addressed it.
Okay. We certainly think of sponges now as animals. Rather than it's like, well, I don't know, is that a plant or now? But, when you look at it, it's like, well, that's a very primitive animal. It doesn't have some of the more definitive, like, internal organs, say, that I immediately think of when I think of an animal.
I always think of things in my kitchen.
Right. I mean, it's so much not like an animal that and it's hardly even like a plant. It's this thing that you use to wash your dishes with, right? Kitchen sink. It's more like an inorganic thing, than an organic thing in many ways, now, of course, we actually make artificial ones, we usually use in the kitchen sink these days rather than a real one. But nonetheless, like they point out, that just gives you a hint at what those true borderline organisms were like. That they just, you could look at them, just quickly and go, I don't know, is it a plant or is it an animal? Hey, and there's some sea animals that are more definitively an animal when you take a look at them. But if you just glance at them, your first thought is, oh, it's one of those colorful sea plants, And then you get in close, it's like, oh, no, this is not a plant at all. This is an animal. Like I said, the idea is to not just merely be reminded of that initial pre-animal gradual phase of things, but what does it what does that tell you about your ancestry, and hence about your nature? What did evolution eventuate into your foundation? Put into your foundation. What is it that your effort to be an ascending son of, your effort to be an ascending son of God, what is that predicated on? And it's predicated on all of these complexities, these challenges. All right.
The bacteria, simple vegetable organisms of a very primitive nature, are very little changed from the early dawn of life. They even exhibit a degree of retrogression in their parasitic behavior. Many of the fungi also represent a retrograde movement in evolution, being plants which have lost their chlorophyll-making ability and have become more or less parasitic. The majority of disease-causing bacteria and their auxiliary virus bodies really belong to this group of renegade parasitic fungi. During the intervening ages, all of the vast kingdom of plant life has evolved from ancestors from which the bacteria have also descended.
Okay, so throw in a paragraph about this retrograde phenomenon that we had so significantly on this world as well. And all of the context that I've highlighted in the previous two paragraphs, see, does it make even more sense now why this is being reiterated? It's not just, like I said, to just remind you of what they told you before. And you notice here they even went a little bit further in bringing in, talking about viruses and pointing out how they're related to these renegade parasitic bacteria. You know, you can just kind of imagine, you know, that as you've got everything progressing forward in general, but you have some things that are going backwards, and just sort of the visualize kind of the friction of them and these parts peeling off, right, that are the viruses, right? It's sort of the debris of that process of them grinding backwards against the flow of evolution. You know, just to kind of visualize, you know, why there's these auxiliary virus bodies, right? I mean, they're not an organism, you know, they're just some, you know, they're part of, basically, an organism. You know, they're not alive, you know, they're just like a salt crystal with a, you know, melting point and a boiling point and whatnot, you know, outside of a cell, but it's unlike a salt crystal, if you put it into a cell, it has the machinery to start messing around with the machinery of your eukaryotic cell, right? I mean, yeah, too much salt, you know, will be a problem in the cell too, you know, but this is, you know, this isn't just a generalized alteration of the chemistry. I mean, this is machinery, right? Those viruses. What was that?
Prokaryotic?
Well, again, no, they're not eukaryotes or prokaryotes. Viruses are just, you know, they're just molecules.
Mm-hmm. Bacteria, were they prokaryotes?
Bacteria are prokaryotes, yeah. Bacteria are actual prokaryotes. They're actual organisms.
So even though they say evolved from the ancestors
of the bacteria. Hey, I'll get to that in just a second. I'll bring that up, yeah, in just a second. Yeah.
The loosening of constraints.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that only in the initial pattern, or are you talking about in the way that mind engages the system, the constraints are looser?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a whole package. I mean, they are altering the structures that they've constructed and the DNA that they've designed with so that mind engages it differently. Because again, they want to evolve pre-sangic will creatures. You know, what over controls that evolution? Mind. I mean, they have to alter the way mind engages the matter so that that influence leads to pre-sangic will creatures. You know, it's not a matter of, you know, you just have the same old mind thing happening as always. You've just varied what's going on underneath it. You know, as you know, they talk about how difficult and it was for mind to engage things here. I mean, it's, you know, so it's very much you know, a whole package.
I see.
Yeah. See, and again, you know, you see it. You think about what they said up front before this section. Right? They remind you about the life carriers designing, and they remind you about how they're designing, understanding the physics of mind and how it engages. Right. So, you know, they knew that there would be some issues, some tangential issues. They didn't fully appreciate how problematic it would be, and they especially didn't anticipate the default. Well, you know, not so much the rebellion, you know, immediately, but the default. I mean, of course, there was a default basically because there was a rebellion. But you know, remember how they say that? You know, when they saw this happen, it's like, well, okay, it's going to be okay. You'll get the biologic uplift, and you know, and that will, you know, solidify things so that all these little nibblers, you know, can't do any real harm. Yep.
I wonder if chlorophyll is an antidote to some of these bacterial problems. I mean, I know you can buy it in a health food store.
No, again, it's just, I mean, the only fundamental antidote to this is to not be down at their level, right? To be uplifted. You know the fact if you're under a vegetable assault. And you're too vegetable-like, right? When we call each other potted plants, you know.
But there's materials that are medicinal remedies.
Again, I mean, you're dealing with symptoms and stuff, you know, but the fundamental problem, you know, is genetic, not chemical. Right? You know, before mankind understood genetics, we had, you know, we thought of ourselves just in chemical terms, and we there's an element there, you know, whether it's produced by a pharmaceutical company or as a quote unquote natural remedy of great tradition or whatever the heck it is, right? I mean, you're just approaching yourself chemically, you know, with those, you know, and there's a limit to how much that can do. When fundamentally it's a genetic issue, right? No remedy of any sort, no matter how natural, quote unquote, or how artificial, you know, quote unquote, it might be, is going to, you know, fundamentally alter the genetic issues.
Do you suppose that having the insight where an issue came from might help them in their research to figure out which direction to go?
Yes, yeah. I mean, that's a little sidelight with this. I think maybe we even mentioned that way back when we were talking about this issue before, right? I mean, to focus the scientists on that fact, to start with sort of the truth of it before you bury your head down in all the detailed facts of it, right? That the fundamental problem is that we're too vegetable-like, right? It's not just a matter of tweaking you horizontally with different molecules, you know, this remedy or that remedy. You know, that's just basically moving you horizontally. It's a vertical problem. There's just too much of it, much of us down there very low. And on top of that, it's not, like I said, it's not only down very low, but it's very fine, you know, and very susceptible to assault by minutiae. Right, you know, even that which is so minute as viruses.
I had a thought. So they had to have a range for the mother to grab a hold of, so that there'd be something in that range that she could get a hold of to push forward.
Yeah. I mean, that's very much like we've talked about there. And that when I used the general expression of loosening the constraints, you know. You're giving this greater leeway for the evolutionary process to search about horizontally. See, now they obviously have also done things to sort of block off so that it doesn't get to Sangic first. Right? But then they've also loosened it up so it can find some way to get to pre-Sangic first. Right? You know, it's going to be a very complex thing of allowing for more possibilities and not allowing for some. I mean, they know all those details. They would have constrained it. To think of it in these long dynamic terms of all of the vicissitudes that would come up and all the different ways mind adapts to all those different vicissitudes. They know how this can go. What they need to do, it's not something as simple as just, I'm building it like this because that's the way I want it, you know. They have to have great foresight and just very deep knowledge of all of the minutiae details, all the subtleties that can crop up over hundreds of millions of years, you know. Just think of how much experiential wisdom goes into, you know, something like this. Right?
I think they still have a few curveballs that, well, we didn't see that coming.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's always things that you know, but they know there's things that they can't anticipate, so they design for that. That you know, even if a whole bunch of things I never even imagined crop up, you know, it still can get to where I want it to get to. Yeah.
David Jones is wondering if you think that the cure for cancer and other issues will have to await higher genetics.
We don't need, you don't necessarily need higher genetics. We just need to be able to micromanage our genetic nature. You know, we have to get into some very detailed genetic engineering to engage the problem as it is, you know, rather than continuing to think that, well, you know, if I just, you know, alter the mist in the air, you know, it's like it's not, you know, that's not the fundamental problem. You know? And remember, it's not just health issues, but so much of our intellectual issues are genetic too, right? Right. You know, like the relatives try to point out, I mean, all of the basic societal ills that you're trying to solve with all these false notions you have, you know, those aren't going to get you anywhere because the problem's genetic, right? It doesn't matter how much you redistribute wealth, no one's DNA is changed, you know? You can pass a million laws, no one's DNA is changed. You know, you can have a trillion regulations, no one's DNA has changed. You know, and they try to get us, you know, you see, and that's, you know, we're touching upon that here again, you know, trying to get you to be grounded in the facts. You know, one must face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. We need to face the facts of our nature. Even if there hadn't been the rebellion and the default, we still would have had this very basal animal nature that everything would have been predicated on. Yeah. You know, you still would have been predicated on a pre-sangic will creature, for instance. Right? No matter what. And that's the basic point of this planet, you know, is for us to achieve high degrees with starting, you know, pretty much down as low as you can get, right? To really flesh out the full range of the finaliter. Not just basically down at the bottom up to the top, but I mean totally down to the bottom and all the way to the top. Someone has to plumb the depths and get up to the top. Okay, let's see. Is there anything else there that we need to touch on? Right. Your issue. Yeah. So at the end there, so during the intervening ages, all of the vast kingdom of plant life has evolved from ancestors from which the bacteria have also descended. Okay. Now, you have to carefully notice the words. It doesn't say from which the bacteria have also evolved. Right, descended, just, you know, from which the bacteria are derived. Right, just, you know, what do you mean by saying descended there? Prokaryotes don't evolve. Okay, so none of these bacteria, none of these prokaryotes have literally, in and of themselves, been evolved. Okay. But they are involved in a process, and they are, in, as they're pointing out, in a very intimate interaction with the evolutionary stream. You know, they're kind of latched onto it and being drug along for the ride. And we all know that if you advance the thing that's under attack, the little things that are attacking adapt, figure out a way, you know. See, so they're basically being drugged forward. They're not evolving, but they're moving forward with what's evolving, trying to keep up the attack. Okay? So, you know, evolution, you know, say it this way, evolved implies descended, but descended does not imply evolved.
Why do they use also then?
Right?
Seems to sort of...
Right, well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, everything started... Okay, so think about how it started. On this planet, you had... most immediately with plants, let's keep it simple. Let's start with the cyanobacteria, Right, those prokaryotes that were generating the oxygen, you know, they're like a little single-celled plant, but they're not a eukaryote.
When the life carriers first showed up, right?
What was that?
About a billion years ago when the life carriers first showed up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it started 900 million years ago. Yeah. You know, you had these prokaryotic, quote-unquote, plants, right? Plant-like prokaryotes. And you know, when you design the first eukaryotic plants, you need those little power plants. You need those chloroplasts in those single-celled algae, and they just you know they remember they told you they did it in place there. They took those power plants that we already had here and just modified them and put them into the eukaryotic plant cells, right? So, see both the plant life and then the prokaryotes that are you know. That remain, they're both starting. See, basically the same point. They're both predicated on what those cyanobacteria, for instance, were that the master physical controllers designed, you know, and were in place here. See, so that's what they're getting at. They have a common starting point, and when you get them going renegade, you know, and losing their chlorophyll, and then becoming parasitic and attacking. See, you know, again, they're predicated on those, you know, it's like those cyanobacteria. Okay, that's what they're getting at. But it's just very important to notice that they, you know, that they use the word descended there. So, you know, it's what they're saying is true, right? Because fundamentally, prokaryotes don't evolve. They can't. They don't reproduce. They produce copies. Right? A copy doesn't evolve, right? It's the same over and over and over and over. I mean, it doesn't evolve. Right? And it's only with that reproduction process that allows for change, for evolution. Unless, you know, you literally have it being, altered in a more direct way in some fashion. But just, you know, in and of itself, a natural evolution, no. All right.
It's still mysterious to me, this descendant. Mm-hmm. You mean they're they started out at this level and they?
Well, don't think vertical with the word descend. Just like your descendants, you know. Do you think of your descendants as going down from you?
Okay.
No, no. That's not like descendants, ancestors and descendants.
Okay.
That kind of
they were
right, that kind of descended, as in descendants, okay. Right? The current bacteria are descendants of the prokaryotes that were there to begin with.
They're the same as the ones that were there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, right, the ones that haven't been altered or renewed are literally identical, to, you know, basically to what they were, you know, 900 million years ago. Yeah, and right, so. Yeah, so just now, that's what they're trying to get you at. You know, you can talk about them as having changed, okay? But just appreciate that, you know, that's just, you know, they're an issue of the subsequent ones are derived from the former ones, but the subsequent ones aren't an evolutionary consequence, you know, of the former ones. I mean, they're not evolving, okay? So they're just throwing in that little bit of precision there. All right. Let's see. I think we got everything there then. The one little comment. Notice how they throw in a little bit of anthropomorphism, you know, of renegades, calling them renegades.
Retrogrades.
Yeah. I mean, they are retrograde, but, you know, but to give them that, you know, that they are in revolt. See, against the plan. All right, there's a plan, and they're revolting against it. Effectively, I mean, no, I'm not going to go with the forward flow that you've designed, the progression. You know, I'm going to pull myself out, and I'm going to go the other direction, and I'm going to go on the attack. And see, and just think about how we feel like we are under assault by a human assailant, Right, a willful assailant as we're attacked by bacteria and viruses. You can see why they anthropomorphized it like that.
Parasitic right. is another.
Yeah. Okay.
Kind of a pattern on this planet.
It's just yet another opportunity to be a sublime egg and daughter. Yes. I mean, anyone can handle those spiritual assaults, but can you handle a spiritual assault at the same time you're being hit at the vegetable level? You know, it's just, you know,
just ring it out.
They're just getting you from every direction here. Okay, keep going here.
The higher protozoan type of animal life soon appeared, and appeared suddenly, and from these far distant times, the amoeba, the typical single-celled animal organism, has come on down but little modified. He disports himself much today as he did when he was the last and greatest achievement in life evolution. This minute creature and his protozoan cousins are the animal creation, are to the animal creation what bacteria are to the plant kingdom. They represent the survival of the first early evolutionary steps in life differentiation together with failure of subsequent development.
Okay, so we have a basic thing. Okay, we have the suddenly, protozoan, first animals, our first animal. We've gone through that, the amoeba, again, typical single-celled animal organism. But, it's obvious what they want you to think about a little bit more here, because they italicized that ending. Failure of subsequent development, and even saying failure. They are, they're again, remember what advantage point we're supposed to have as we're considering this. Not bottom up, not down there with the molecules, kind of watching them evolve before our eyes through all those hundreds of millions of years. But thinking about the top-down influence of mind upon that. You have this mind that's engaging all these organisms. And some of those organisms, it can find a way to progress them forward. And other organisms, it can't. That mind fails to progress them. Okay? That's why they're stressing this, and saying it that way. It's not that the failure is not on the part of the designers. Oh, the life carriers, man, they really had a blind spot there. They had this great plan and it failed. No, see, that's not the proper interpretation of the failure. Right? Think about, and of course it's as it should be. Certain things come into existence like we talked about and remain as these foundation elements for mind to seed upon going forward. But, but think about how it's, the mind is engaging everything, trying to advance everything. It fails to advance some things. Oh, and coincidentally, the things that it fails to advance are the things that need to be ongoing and relatively changeless. Right? "Quote unquote," coincidentally, right? Now there are no coincidences in the wholeness of this evolutionary system, the evolution of this system. That's the way that they're trying to get you to think about it from this top-down perspective. Put yourself in the place of the adjutants, and you've got the hands that can grab a hold of all these living material systems, and you're trying to move them forward to will creatures. And you're going, I want to go that direction. Well, I can't go directly. So let me go over to the left a little bit and then forward a little bit and then back over here. And okay, now I can go forward. And, you're trying to find a way to move about horizontally to get it to go forward. Or if you want to picture it in vertical, you're moving it about horizontally, trying to figure out how to get it to move upward, to progress upward. And you're trying to work with this. It's like, I just can't do anything with that. Why don't I just lean on that and I'll work on this other stuff? Oh, cool, that's really handy. I need something to lean on like that to steady myself so I can work on the finer details. See, and that's what's going on, right? Those initial levels that are laid out steady the foundation of the mind so it can work on ever finer details until it has this whole big solid foundation built up, and it can do these very minute things of getting the seventh adjutant to engage finally. Right? All predicated on that hierarchical stabilization of the mind energy system on this planet. And see, when all is said and done, then the life carriers can look back and see how clever the whole is. It's like, oh, here's what the way it found, right? Remember, this is the way we're talking about that's doing this, the mother, right? And you can literally see that way made organisms, made system of organisms of where are the anchor points, where are the opportunity points for going upward. How did it all it eventually produce this whole system, right? And that's what they're wanting you to think about.
Their word disport, I don't know.
So disport, it's kind of a fun thing. Again, you could take it in kind of the anthropomorphic flavor they started with the renegades, and saying, he amuses himself, or plays with himself today much as he did when he was, but the port part is carry, like a portage. Right? I mean, so, the more straightforward way, he carries on, today much as he did.
Right? Well, what I picked up on is these early animals are single cell.
Yep.
They're individuals.
Yes.
They're kind of complete in themselves, but as an individual, they're isolated. They can't. It's like an individualist today.
Yeah.
Might be fine, but what good are they if there's no association?
Yeah. See, and that's exactly. See, and that's why they didn't just say carries on, but they used that discourse because you go, oh, so he amuses himself, plays with himself, very individuated. Huh, do you suppose they're going to talk about collective next? Yeah, right, the next sentence. See, you picked up on it, right? So you picked up on the, that's what, see how masterly they've constructed it, in those words, that if you're reflecting, if you're looking for the flavor of what they're presenting, they get you into the proper space. It's like, okay, so it starts out very individuated. Then what? You picked up on it exactly.
I read ahead.
It's funny because you got here late.
but it all is designed by the author, right? By the life carrier that's writing this, in what words he chooses. When he talks about, later on, there's another spot where they, use disports, right? And then it's much, not just merely carries on, but, amusing themselves, playing with themselves, blue man in Europe, with his head stuck in his navel, right? If you can search for the other spot in the book where they use that, and see that. But here, by throwing in that potential for a little bit of anthropomorphic, giggling or smiling about what they're saying there, it gets you in that mode. It's like, yeah, they're all alone, right? There was something. It was here.
So here again, we've got an experimental world.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything that's happening in this evolutionary process is foreknown. I mean, in other words, so they must be learning, this happened, and then I would hope they would use that in future experiments or future things to be able to not have the things that they didn't like the way it turned out. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, and not just, remember, not just in that mode is it an experiment. It's like, well, let's try this. Oh, no, that leads to too much cancer. Okay, so we're not going to do it that way next time. There is that element, but there's also, remember, they're putting the supreme to a test. The most fundamental test they're doing is not testing their design new design ideas, but they're actually looking for, at this point in time, how is the supreme adapting? I mean, you give the supreme the same set of facts today, and it will adapt to them differently than the supreme did a billion years ago. It doesn't, the supreme is evolving, in the same way that you don't face the exact same situation now than you did when you were five, right? Right, in contrast to the changeless God, right? God the Father, right? Where we don't even want to face the fact that the Universal Father is changeless. You know, we're still pretty certain that if we pray just so, we can change the changeless God. Like, no, you can't do anything. It's absolutely changeless. But there is a changing God, right? There is experiential deity. So besides reminding you that you did finally get a suddenly in contrast to the gradual, giving you those basic elements, so that you can see how there's so much more potential to see this as you. It's they're purposely anthropomorphizing, see, so that you think about this as the evolution of you and not of protozoa. Just, right? Let's see. I think we got everything there, didn't we? Other than just, I'll get you in 1 second. At the end there, they represent the survival, that bit of, the... we explained that, when they say that this minute creature and his protozoan cousins are to the animal creation what bacteria are to the plant kingdom, remember the details. Don't think like current scientists that literally you had cyanobacteria that somehow magically evolved into a eukaryotic cell. That's not what, they aren't validating that belief that somehow prokaryotes can turn into eukaryotes, just through the magic of evolution. Right? I mean, that linkage, it was built in there by the life carriers building the eukaryotic cell to match those prior prokaryotes. So we look at them, it's like, well, it looks like it evolved. Yeah, but think about it. It's impossible. It couldn't have evolved. You can't magically turn a prokaryote into a eukaryote. Where does all the complexity come from? Right? You're making something out of nothing. Right? But you go, but yes, but they're so similar. Yeah, so what does that mean? Right? Someone designed the eukaryote to be similar to those pre-existent prokaryotes. The eukaryotes are predicated, but by beings, they are predicated. By the hands of beings are they predicated, not by the mysteries of the evolutionary process are they merely predicated. Yeah.
I guess it's just a side note now, but somewhere in the life carrier, somewhere, it says something like, no matter how crazy... Like,
you're coming up on it. Don't jump a gun. Don't jump the gun.
That's a mistake. Something like that.
Yep. All right, so keep going here.
Before long, the early single-celled animal types associated themselves in communities, first on the plan of the Volvox, and presently along the lines of the Hydra and jellyfish. Still later, there evolved the starfish, stone lilies, sea urchins, sea cucumbers, centipedes, insects, spiders, crustaceans, and the closely related groups of earthworms and leeches, soon followed by the mollusks, the oyster, octopus, and snail. Hundreds upon hundreds of species intervened and perished. Mention is made only of those which survived the long, long struggle. Such non-progressive specimens, together with the later appearing fish family, today represent the stationary types of early and lower animals, branches of the tree of life, which failed to progress.
Yeah, so we've already well explained this failed to progress part. I often remind you of a very definitive one of those foundational groups, the fish, right, that go on from the Devonian to today, basically unchanged. A very, very foundational element for, that more sophisticated level of foundation, something that's vertebrate.
Is Volvox like the planet of Thetans?
No, this is not science fiction. What Volvox is a colony plant. So this is one of the most important sentences in the book, believe it or not, to understanding the last few hundred years of human history. Okay, this is the spot, and Gene, I was talking to Gene there about noticing that by themselves thing. That so you have two modes in which mind can engage, and you're going, well, wait a minute. I mean, we're talking about animals here. You're saying Volvox is plant? Yes. Okay, it just has mechanical mind. But it doesn't matter if it just has mechanical mind or if it also has the first adjutant. That remember what mind is. Mind is an energy phenomenon that is synchronized to matter, individuality, on one end, and to spirit substance, unity, on the other end. That associativity that is the functioning of mind energy has in it two modes. It can lead with individuality, if you will, or lead with the unity as end of its associativity. Just to kind of think of it simplistically. Why there's fundamentally two modes of functioning for each of the adjutants. The adjutants start out engaging just in an individuality mode. Here we're just talking about the first adjutant with, like, the amoeba, with the protozoa. Right? That's the first adjutant just engaging in an individuality mode. Every animal is a little universe unto itself, basically. But slowly, the first adjutant figures out how to engage animals collectively. And you get colonies. You get collective expressions. In the same way that the mechanical mind ministry initially was going from individuality to collective engagement and making things like it still does today, the Volvox. Okay. So you'll have like a colony of creatures where they're basically single-celled creatures, and you can take one out of the colony and it'll function all by itself, just like it was an individual. But it can also function beyond that individuality mode in a colony, in a collective mode. And so just recognizing that each of the adjutants is striving first to engage in an individuality mode, to engage me, for the seventh adjutant to engage me as an individual. But the seventh adjutant is also working, trying to get to the point where it can engage at least the spear point of humanity collectively, the leading edge of humanity collectively. Right? To use its more innate unity nature, right? To produce a collective expression of its functioning. And so that's why, when I talk about the fourth adjutant dawning in the collective, the fifth adjutant dawning in the collective, the sixth adjutant dawning in the collective, And as you go from the 18th to the 19th to the 20th century, right, basically the middle of each century, right, and now we're quivering on the very brink of the seventh adjutant dawning in the collective. The seventh adjutant being able to produce the first colony-like, right, plan of the Volvox, right, expression, right? That's you know, it's here, it's right here that they give you that little tidbit. You know, they don't, like I said, they don't lay it all out. They're waiting for you to recognize. Like, well, wait a minute, the first adjutant can do that. All the other ones can too, because it's all the same basic fact of mind energy that has individuality on one end and unity on the other end. Yes, it's a super additive consequence, but it has, you know, as that super additive consequence, it can put, you know, either face forward, you might say.
It has the same pattern, whether it's at this teeny little level or at even at our level, it's a similar kind of pattern.
Right. Just notice, you don't have to have directly unity ministry, a spirit ministry, directly engaged. You know, remember that there is unity likeness innate in mind. See? And that's what we're, you know, that's what we're, you know, reminding ourselves here, is that you know, you can have, you know, something that just has mechanical mind, plant, manifest this collective expression as if spirit ministry had engaged it, you know, unity influence had been imposed upon it. No, not directly, but indirectly, right? It's there. And so, you know, you build up with mind, and when you finally can get a collective expression of the seventh adjutant, you're right there on the doorstep of having the Holy Spirit, a genuine spirit ministry, have a means to interface with the system in a way that it never had before, right? Not second-hand unity, but direct unity. Having a way to have a collective manifestation. See, at that point, the potential for the brotherhood of man is now game on. See? We're quivering on the very brink. Now, of course, it's a double-edged sword. You know, we could also be quivering on the very brink of the interregnum. You know, it depends on how this goes. But we are quivering on that very brink, whether or not that full unity potential is going to engage us creatively or destructively.
But eventually.
Right. I mean, again, if there's a period of interregnum, again, you know, everyone should have the integrity to not start panicking when we talk about the interregnum. Right? I mean, if nothing else, you'll be long gone before there's an interregnum. Don't worry about it individually. You know, nothing to fear here. But again, I mean, you know, we're to be able to just face the facts without fear. You know, even if there is an interregnum, there still will be light in life. But anyway, that's okay. So that's it's when the light bulb goes off as you're reflecting on this that you get to the point that I did so many years ago. It's like, oh, wait a minute. Collective expression. And see, what would the collective expression of the fifth adjutant look like? Duh. You know, all right, the social reformation movement in the middle of the 19th century. I mean, it's just so trivially obvious. You know, what would the collective expression of the fourth adjutant look like? Oh, do you suppose the Industrial Revolution, right, in the middle? Yeah, it's just so obvious. You know, and then you think about it, it's like, oh, yeah, and of course, I could have figured that out myself if I just reflected more precisely on the nature of mind. Of course, it's got to have an ability to engage in a very individuality mode and an ability to engage in a collective mode. It's the super additive consequence of individuality and unity.
So what is the seventh going to look like?
Yeah, that's how you, when you can really start to get into the quest for knowledge and wisdom, see, and move out of the material comfort era, right? That's the means to move out of the material comfort era.
Would it take only a few to do that?
You have to at least have the leaders, right? Cross that threshold.
And you have to be able to be led.
And then the leaders
can't be anything but what the people vote.
To Chris's point, I mean, even if you have the leaders done, remember we're also a rebellion world. And all those that should follow, their first thought is, you're not the boss of me. Caligastia told me, you're not the boss of me. So we've got this problem. You know, even if the fifth epical revelation does what it's meant to do and encourages, that 1% of people that can be leaders to become more definitively, objectively minded as they should be, whether or not they can lead anyone on this rebellion world remains to be seen. I mean, you're wanting to lead them to high things, but you're going to have to use some pretty difficult methods, to whip them into shape, probably.
I think there's a percent of people who are willing to be led even now.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. You know, it just all depends on, not even the revelators know how this is going to play out. If enough people say you're not the boss of me, well, then there's going to be an interregnum.
One of my pet peeves are these opinion surveys I get in the mail, where they want me to check all my opinions, like they're going to craft their their governance based on my opinion. Yeah.
I think I want to swear here.
Who cares about my opinions? Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't know the right thing to do,
you're not a leader.
Consulting me for my opinion.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Right. That's just.
They keep those in a database. Right. They keep them in a database for years and pass them.
They just want some money.
But right. I mean, but again, but to Gene's point, I mean, appreciate that. So we've gotten very confused about leadership. Not only those that need to be led, but those that think they should lead. I mean, don't know what a leader is. A leader doesn't figure out what to do by doing an opinion poll. I mean, that's not a leader, right? That's someone throwing the grass up in the air on the fairway to see which way the wind is blowing. Back to this. So it starts out. It starts out in going from the individual manifestation of the first adjutant to the collective manifestation of the first adjutant with very little differentiation of cells. See, when they go on and say, and then presently along the lines of the hydra and the jellyfish, getting into those initial rudimentary differentiation of cells, where you don't just literally have every cell is identical, but they're working in a collective mode. You start to get, eventually you have skin cells and heart cells and, whatnot, all the differentiation of cells, specialization of cells. The more and more the mind can engage it and begin to guide it into that differentiation. Who decides which cells are going to become head, in the head, and which cells are going to become be part of the tail, right? It's that over control of mind. These cells are going to become brain, and these cells are going to become heart. Is there something else?
Just a quick question from David Jones. Mm-hmm. Are we seeing the social manifestation of the sixth adjutant now?
Right, the sixth adjutant dawned in the collective in the middle of the 20th century, and that's when everything went squirrely. Because that's no man's land. That's the unstable one. That's the adolescent phase. That's the difficult transition that we're in. There's some basic stability with the fifth adjutant, and obviously stability with the seventh. And but when you just have the sixth, that's why everything turned into an ism. All right, the religious impulse took hold of everything, and in this collective mode, And everyone is, making isms out of everything now and flying off in every direction, but of course, again, that's a prerequisite to being able to join or reject the rebellion. You have to be spiritually animated enough to join the rebellion. The prosaic animal-like amongst us, can't synchronize with the rebellion. Again, it's that difficult transition phase. You now have what you need to go forward, but you also have what you need to unwittingly join the rebellion and be self-destructive.
Yeah, it's not physical darkness, it's spiritual darkness.
Right, and you start to notice that the irony that you have the sixth adjutant dawning in the collective, so you have these movements, of sort of just sort of purposeless energy. But it quickly starts to feed back, and breeds a newfound, amped up individuality. Right, it's heading towards self-righteousness.
Okay.
Everything gets, it starts to get, very, and so what initially had a tendency to form this excited collective, it starts to devour itself from within. And eventually, it's like, well, now that I think about it, you're just slightly different. And, it starts to become hyper-individuated. To the point of individual destruction.
When Jesus was talking when he was on trial, and he said that you have faith, and you are knowingly rejecting the light of God. How could you?
And remember, see, the difference between what Jesus, was speaking to as the fourth epical revelator compared to what the fifth epical revelation is addressing. It's the fifth epical revelation is not addressing spiritual darkness. I was just pointing out that there is some negative individuality potential in play. But fundamentally, that's not the issue. The issue is this is the collective civilizational phenomenon. And that you want to have an influence, an even greater collective influence, to have an even tighter civilization, social manifestation. But in order to get to that, you have to go through this difficult thing that has the potential to get an energy in the system for a greater integrity, the sixth adjutant. But in and of itself, quickly becomes a negative. It actually starts to tear apart rather than ever further collectivize. Right? So it's, but in general, see, the individuals, because of Pentecost, are fine. The individuals aren't going to iniquity. They're just unwittingly, it's not a spiritual issue, it's a wisdom issue. Hence unwitting secularists, why they use that word unwitting, because it's the lack of wisdom, it's the lack of objective recognition, that you need to take a hold of this energy and you have to purpose it. It doesn't purpose itself so much like it seemed to before. Where kind of just naturally you collect together and you do fancier things and in the wake of the fifth adjutant dawning in the collective in the middle of the 19th century, right? We got all these wonderful new collective social expressions that developed. Everything from Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts to you name it. All these things that cropped up with this new sense of social integrity that we had. But you know, now we're in this mode where you pour gasoline on that, and don't bring in the governor, right? And so now it's just, you know, burning down the house, unless we get a hold of it. And, but the individuals are basically fine, but the collective phenomenon is being torn apart.
Like you said, there are no sexagenic creatures.
There are no stable sexagenic creatures, right? And it doesn't magically become a stable phenomenon if you collectivize it. It's inherently unstable. Because after all, think about it, a collective is just sort of a super individual, right? Yep.
But you can really see that, you know, you almost have to go through that to get out to the other side. Hmm. Because it doesn't just magically get to the other side.
No,
so hopefully, when it gets bad enough, or it gets, people will go, will wise up, as they say.
Yeah. You know, just reflect on the basic challenge that we face. I mean, how do when each of us as an individual goes through that difficult transition, we start to get really fired by the sixth. But don't have a lot of governor in play yet. And how do most of us get through that? Well, it's predicated on the guidance of parenting before that. You know, the parenting, gets you going, so usually the child makes it through that difficult transition and gets to the other side and can kind of take a hold of the reins themselves. On a normal world, you have parents guiding civilization through that difficult transition. We don't. So unlike a normal world, we have to be self-parenting to quite a degree. See, that's...
Adam and Eve.
Yeah, you know, planetary prince and his staff, and that, you know, all those planetary authorities being our parents, you know, guiding us forward. We don't have that, so you know, it requires self-parenting here, you know, of a high degree.
Well, the sixth adjutant, which is the spirit of worship, or
potentially,
energy
of zeal to begin with.
In a way, we need true religion. Because right now there's a lot of spirit influence, but God is the centering influence. God is the centering influence.
Right, and the anchor. And
we can have lots of spiritual energy going about, but if we don't connect to the centering influence, to God, I mean, to get to the seventh, I'm just trying to figure out, how do you get to the seventh? You have to marshal that somehow.
Well, remember that, I mean, especially like when we're talking here with evolution, and we're not talking about the spirit of anything here.
Right.
Right? We're talking about an individual and a collective energy functioning. Uh-huh. Right? And, so in terms of the sixth adjutant energy, right, having this collective functioning, basically what it does is the energy of zeal, it just turns up the speed knob, you know, if you will. It, like I said, pours gasoline on it, whatever analogy you want to use. It amps things up. And you're saying, well, how do you, how do you bring that under control? Well, one way to just think about it, it's like, well, if I have something that's moving faster now and I don't want it racing off into la-la land, I need to put it in orbit. It can go fast if it's in orbit, and it won't, fly apart. Right, yeah. Put yourself in orbit about it, your God nucleus. Right? Put it yourself in orbit about that nucleus, right? And that's what you're supposed to do. But when you say you're spiritual but not religious, you're saying, I will not be nucleated. I'm going to go off on a straight line towards infinity. Yeah. But the before you think about that in such a choice way, such a willful way, remember what the seventh adjutant is as just an energy. It's the energy of symmetry. When it functions, it imposes balance and proportion upon the other adjutants. It's superior to them, and it can say to the sixth adjutant, your volume knob is up too far, back it off, dude, all right? And it does. Now, that energy just naturally functions that way. It imposes balance and proportion on the other six adjutants. You know, so just, see, opening yourself up to allowing it to function, being curious about something beyond your religious impulse, right? I mean, allowing some space for that energy to function, for that philosophic, you know, it's eventually, you know, in the fullest sense of philosophic impulse.
You can see how
you just have to allow for that.
As a student of the revelation, you can see how it has, how it functions in you. You know, and when people talk about being spiritual versus religious, I think they're more talking about the human religions, you know.
Yes,
versus
we all know what they're talking about, but see, unwittingly,
you know what I'm saying?
Unwittingly,
so they don't know what else to do.
They're moving themselves away from that nucleus. See,
yes,
that,
and no. I mean, I think, you know, most people who are spirits are really looking for God. And
yeah, see, and no, and see, those people you're talking about, why are they stable like that? You're saying that they're not, they don't all go unstable. Well, why do some, like you're thinking of, why don't they go unstable? Because they still identify with a tradition. You know, there's a stabilizing influence to legacy, tradition, and convention. You know, if you identify with the history of the Christian church, you may say, but I want to free myself from the atonement doctrine or something like that, right? But I really honor the focus on Jesus that's been here for 2,000 years. Okay, see, you're being stabilized. You're being grounded by that tradition, and that's very important. But the problem is those that don't feel that, it's like, no, I'm going to let go of all the mores, all the traditions. I'm going to chart an independent course. I'm going to be a free thinker, quote unquote. All right, I'm going to cast off all of that ecclesiastical tradition.
We'll start throwing the baby out of the bath.
Yeah, those are the ones I'm always talking about. I mean, that, because that
people will do that in the ranch too. They'll find things that, and then all of a sudden it's no good. Yeah. You're right.
But
I see what you're saying.
And so just, but think about here an example of this, allowing space for the seventh adjutant to function, just the energy of it, and how that's more and more not being allowed. We used to challenge ourselves, even if there was no way we would ever adopt that other person's ideas, we would at least allow ourselves to listen to them. Like we would go to a university, and we would sit in a group, and we would calmly lay down our sword and listen to that other tribe's mores, you know, and consider them. It's like, well, okay, all of a sudden I just don't feel a resonance with that, but I will tolerate its existence. See, notice that we're losing that. We're not allowing any space for that energy of symmetry anymore. We're saying no. I'm not even going to allow you to open your mouth. I'm not even going to allow you to be in the same room as me, because I know what you're going to say. I have unchallengeable, preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices.
I do have a hard time. Jehovah's come to my door, and sorry, I want to talk to me for.
But you understand what I'm saying? I mean, just notice what the sixth adjutant is starting to do. Right? Instead of just further energizing the collective, it's starting to tear it apart because we're fixating on it and to the point where we're not allowing any space for the seventh adjutant to even function as an energy. You know, by just calming yourself and listening to the other tribe, you know, present their mores, see, allows an opportunity for that energy of symmetry to get in there, and you're not noticing it, and it turns the volume down a little bit on the sixth adjutant and turns up some other knobs.
What is the positive side then of the quivering of the brake that begins to happen?
The positive
people on in, you know, as a collective or as, you know, in groups or in, you know, as coming, that they all begin to allow that.
See, we're quivering on the very brink of people allowing that sixth adjutant predicate to be just that, a predicate for the seventh adjective and function in the collective. And there to be, that collective, they will pursue wisdom as their key passion. Like the revelators say, remember, the quest for, that quest for wisdom will become primary. But the tricky thing is you have to, if we don't allow a tempering of the sixth adjutant, the seventh adjutant can't dawn in the collective. If we let the collective functioning of the sixth adjutant sort of tear it all apart, there isn't going to be that leading edge of humanity where the seventh adjutant is going to dawn in the collective. I mean, why didn't the fourth adjutant dawn in the collective back in 500 BC? Why did it take until the 18th century? Right? Because it couldn't. There wasn't the predicate for it. Right? So we have the potential for the seventh adjutant dawn in the collective, but we can disrupt that. And that's what the revelation is about. If you disrupt that, it's not going to happen. There's going to be an interregnum. It'll tear you apart. It'll tear the collective, the tenuous collective phenomenon you have apart, and you'll be back to, the first two developmental epochs. You'll be back to the nutrition age, or the nutrition epoch and the security age. See, that's what's fundamentally in play. You've got to recognize how much we are in the driver's seat now. We can't just lay here and wait to be evolved to the next step, and it's going to be so wonderful. We're not going to get to it, but they're going to talk about that more and more. It's in our hands, right? That's the whole bit about the sheltered bay, high sea analogy, right? I mean, you can't just float on your inner tube on the high sea like you can in the lagoon. You've got to take a hold of the situation, and that's what we're in. It's very much in our hands whether or not that seventh adjutant will dawn in the collective or not. The potential's there, but the actualization is not a given. If the actualization was a given, this book would not be in my lap. Because if the seventh adjutant dawns in the collective and the Holy Spirit begins to function in the collective mode, all the problems on the planet will take care of themselves in a natural evolutionary way. No emergency philosophic text required. Right? But see, it's obviously not a given.
We can't do anything but work on ourselves.
Right, work on yourself.
And like I was saying, this one and that one doesn't get this and that. That's because we don't get it.
And like I said, it's just a matter of allowing a natural tempering to function in your mind. The seventh adjutant will calm you down.
It does.
Just the energy part of it. None of this using it in a free will mode where it's the spirit of wisdom and stuff like that. I mean, just the energy fact of it, it's a governor. It will temper you. Right? It'll calm things down, but you have to allow it. Right? You can choose to not give it space, and that's what's happening. It's like, I am not going to listen to that other person's opinion. I refuse. See, there's none so blind as those who will not see. I mean, that's a willful closing of your eyes.
I think love has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to see that other person that thinks so differently you as your brother or sister, right? A fellow child of God. Right? You have to remind yourself of how, no matter how different you are, you both can go in orbit about one spiritual father. Right? You don't have to be the same planet. But two planets can orbit about one center, and the planets can be different. It's okay. There's a harmony potential. There's no magical unity potential, right? And you can't wish to dissolve the difference of them to you in some wonderful, magical whitewash of unity. You're seeking harmony. The differential remains, If the two of you can go in orbit about a common nucleus, the two of you remain close enough to each other that there's a super additive potential across the two of you to happen. But if you just, you know, turn your back on each other, you know, we short-circuit that super additive potential. Those who genetically favor their unity consciousness and those who genetically favor their individuality consciousness are supposed to, one way or another, walk along together long enough for a super additive consequence to occur. You know, like John Adams and Thomas Jefferson finally choosing to walk parallel to each other, not on top of each other, but parallel to each other, long enough that they both could be benefited by the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two. You added the super additive consequence to John Adams, and you added the super additive consequence to Thomas Jefferson, but they remained John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Right. You didn't pour magical unity liquid over them and wash out the difference between the two of them.
They allowed each other to be different,
yes,
rather than trying to hammer the other one
into their image. Yes, with ever bigger hammers. Yeah, you know, or just plain kill the other one and be done with the annoyance. Right, but more and more, if you don't allow that governor, the sixth adjutant just keeps amping you up, and you will literally publicly call for the death of the person that thinks differently than you. The sixth adjutant can't do anything but take you to that. You know, if you don't get a bridle on it, if you don't allow it to be bridled, right? It just drives you to death to difference. You know, which, you know, ends in you're the only person left on the planet because everyone is different to you to some degree, even those people you think are just like you. You know, try to live in a commune with them for a while. See how long the commune lasts. Right. Sure enough, they're all just annoyingly different, you know, to the point where the commune falls apart before the year's out.
Right. This is why communes are taking over the whole country.
Okay, anyway. Let's try to see if we can finish up this. Let's keep going here. Okay.
The stage was set.
Okay, so just one moment to kind of get us back into place here. So they gave you, see, in just one paragraph there, they gave you that quick sweep through all those basic different types. And so all that diversity sets the stage. For what?
The stage was thus set for the appearance of the first backboned animals, the fishes. From this fish family, there sprang two unique modifications, the frog and the salamander. And it was the frog which began that series of progressive differentiations in animal life that finally culminated in man himself.
Okay, all that, pretty straightforward. But if you have any precise memory, you're going, wait a minute, I just found a contradiction in the book. This says, from the fish family, there sprang two unique modifications. Two different flavors of amphibian. If you go back to, let's see, which paper is this one? It's paper 59, section 5. You know, the age of the frogs. Do you remember what it said there? It said, when the seas were at their height, a new evolutionary development suddenly occurred. Abruptly, the first of the land mammals appeared. There were numerous species of these animals that were able to live on land or in water. Amphibians, right? By definition of the word. These air-breathing amphibians developed from the arthropods whose swim bladders had evolved into lungs. Wait a minute. Here it says they developed from the arthropods, and here it says, what?
They sprang
from the fish family there sprang. What's going on? Okay. This is the one where it really challenges you to, are you in a bottom-up mode, like that paragraph I just went back to, right? Or are you in a top-down mode, right? Are you thinking about what mind is doing, or are you just watching what the molecules are doing, right? Okay, literally, right, I mean, in terms of what animal laid an egg, you know, but instead of something like it hatching out of it, an amphibian hatched out of it, right? It's the arthropods. But in terms of the mind, see, the previous paragraph was reminding this. You have this evolutionary context. I mean, the fish came out the same way, right? You have the mind engaging this system, and the first thing it figures out how to get fish out of that system. And then subsequently, it figures out how to get amphibians out of that system. Okay. It knew how to get amphibians out of the system predicated on how it figured out how to get fish out of the system. Right? From the mind point of view, right, the amphibians spring from the fish family. But not literally, molecularly, right?
That's what the arthropods were in between.
Literally. No, I mean the arthropods are there, and you're pulling fish out of them, and then you're pulling amphibians out of them. You have this common reservoir, and it's figuring out how to advance higher and higher species. But it can't. But the mind can't figure out how to advance amphibians out of that reservoir. Until it first figured out how to advance fish out of that, and predicated on that, it advanced. See, so in advancing amphibians, it advances fishes, but keeps going. See, think about it that way, right? I mean, in that suddenly of the amphibians, halfway through that suddenly, it's a fish, and then the rest of the way through this, by the end of the suddenly, it's an amphibian. See, in one, it's that's what they're getting at. They're trying to get you to think about it from the mind top-down point of view. Right? Not get you locked down there, you know, about the facts, but thinking about more in truth of what's going on, more from the top down.
So in terms of time, when these events mm-hmm. took place, they're almost simultaneous. I mean, we're not talking about eons of
it's
relatively. Boom.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you're... You know, you've got the age of frogs here, and you flip back one section, it says the age of fishes. Okay? All right?
Short-term age,
though. You know, and here it says the arthropods or crustaceans were the ancestors of the first vertebrates. You know, you can go back and look at all the details in terms of literally, you know, which creatures led to which creatures. But from the top-down point of view, from the mind point of view, you know, what is it doing? You know, it's trying to figure, you know, it figured out the first adjunct figured out how to engage individuals, then it figured out how to engage collectively, right? It has raw material, and it's getting more and more clever in how to take that raw material and move it forward. And remember, we focused on that, and initially, it has sort of this common pool, and it's pulling things out of it, rather than just linearly.
There's potential there in the arthropods for both fish and
yes,
amphibians.
Yes, but it has
to... In fish, there's no potential there for amphibians.
Right. Failed to progress. Right? You know, remember that they've been emphasizing that. Right? You get fishes, you know, and they're not just, you know, you don't just use them to get to directly, literally, linearly to amphibians. Right? So again, you see the complexity of the system, and to just put yourself in that mind's eye view on it, you know, and just thinking about how you could get this figured out. Oh, okay, if I can go like that, and I can get a fish. And it's like, oh, yeah, and I could just kind of like do that in a little bit more, and I can go fish amphibian. Right? And that's what it did. See, it's important to actually have a memory of that and go, wait a minute. And now, either you decide, well, whoever wrote this can't even remember what they wrote a few pages back. This is obviously a bunch of garbage. Or, you know, you remember that they're telling you a different story here. They're telling you the top-down story, that perspective. Okay, keep going.
The frog is one of the earliest of surviving human race ancestors. But it also failed to progress, persisting today much as in those remote times. The frog is the only species ancestor of the early dawn races now living on the face of the earth. The human race has no surviving ancestry between the frog and the Eskimo.
Okay, so, I mean, it's like, okay, I remember that basically. I could have gone back and synopsized what we read to that. And what's the point of repeating it here? Reminding you of how you were built, as it were, how you grew into existence through the evolutionary process. That once, you know, we were just talking about how we kind of were in this sort of pool, that pool that they had in that previous paragraph with the listing all the different types of creatures. You know, we had this kind of pool, and it was trying to figure out how to get moving forward from that. And when it finally got the frog out of that kind of morass, that evolutionary morass, it's like, okay, this is it. To humans, right? It starts to take on a much more linear mode. I've got it now. I can go from frog to this, to this, to this, to this, to this. Boom, Dan and Infanta. And so it started to take on a very direct mode. And you literally see that in terms of you know, how it's a lot of a scaffolding sort of a phenomenon that you didn't coincidentally have some of those that failed to progress and are ongoing as foundational. It basically had the foundation, and it finally found the way to squirt forward. And, you know, and it's a very efficient process. It's not going to waste any you know, any time, if you will, you know, any effort, you know, getting to its goal once it can kind of see that goal. It literally ends up being manifested in what survives today. Okay, so that's what they're trying. See, and again, just thinking about the mind has a hold of this system, see? You know, rather than down in all the confusion of all these species that come and go and what the heck is going on, you know, you see it from the top down, it's like, okay, it found it here. And away it went.
Another example. Yeah. Throwing the baby out with the bathwater if you don't use the seventh adjutant to figure it out.
Yeah. So to speak. I'm talking about using my seventh adjutant as I'm talking here, you know, and interpreting this. I mean, you know, step back. You know, and think it. You know, think in more holistic terms. Use, weigh things off. Remember, the seventh adjutant is that energy in your mind that goes, well, see, on the one hand, there's this, and on the other hand, there's that. Right? On the one hand, I have that paragraph back there about them coming from arthropods, and on the other hand, I've got them here coming from fishes. You know, allows you to hold those in your mind at the same time, you know, and if you allow the seventh adjutant to put him there and kind of get him balancing back and forth, that your insight steps in and clarifies what's going on. Okay, that's the way it works.
One other piece.
Yeah.
Watching how you go through the book at home and figure out this stuff, there's a lot of patience that goes in that. Because when he notices these things, he often will just write them down and set them aside. You know, there's this, like, holding tank he's got.
I mean, not literally write them down, but write them down effectively in my mind and put them to the side.
Sometimes he writes them down. Yeah. I'll flip the paper, too.
Yeah, sometimes I write them down literally, yes.
And sometimes it'll be, you know, years until he figures it out. It's like a little puzzle waiting to be solved.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. So just see that sort of platform that the seventh adjutant provides, where it's a place where you can lay things and allow insight to slowly percolate its way into it.
Yeah. Well, another thing about what you were saying, and that is that when you really get to the point to realize that, you know, an epical revelation is not like a book written by humans, so to speak, in other words, that there's got to be an answer versus,
right,
you know, just...
Not Bob goofed up here. Yeah, yeah, right. You know they didn't goof, right?
Remember this life character?
Right, then you get to a point of where it's a different scene. Then you're going to say, okay, at least it gives you the ability to want to go look for what that is. And I think that's what it is. Talk about revelation, how they don't want to give you everything, because then it would just thwart your ability or to go out and find, you know, and you have to,
in the future. And when you do that, and you have to make sure that you actively pull back on the reins of your sixth adjutant, or your, we've been saying six so many times, your second adjutant, because you can rationalize anything.
It's true.
You know, don't just let your clever rationalization ability rationalize those two paragraphs.
And people will tell you that.
Be present with the two humbly, right? And don't form an opinion about the two paragraphs. Allow insight to get you to recognize what the deal is. You have to shut down that rationalization engine of that second adjutant. And
well, the depth of
the hard to do.
Of going to the mind versus going to the facts is an interesting, you know, way to point it out. I mean, it actually makes you realize that there the truth involved, that or that behind the scenes for me. Anyway. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, so see, there's all these delightful sidelights to what we're going through here. Okay, so let's see. Okay, we got to there, yep, so keep going.
The frogs gave rise to the Reptilia, a great animal family which is virtually extinct, but which, before passing out of existence, gave origin to the whole bird family and the numerous orders of mammals.
You know, if you know anything about, how biologists break things up into sets and subsets and all that, and they use words like family and phylum and those sorts of things. They're not using those precisely. I mean, but if you're not aware of that, that won't be attention. But I just want to note that for anyone. You'll see we're going to get to a little paragraph where they actually are using those technical biologic terms here in a second. But, here they're just using words like family and stuff is, that set, that group type.
Reptilia being all the reptiles? Yeah,
all, and the dinosaurs and all those flavor of creatures. Yeah. And you just notice they're going to quickly step you through. Like I said, I mean, it's found the way. And so, it's going to go from amphibians to reptilia, et cetera, boom, 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 to mammals, and you're going to have humans. So they're just going to quickly step you through those flagstones that they're, that the evolutionary thing skipped along.
Probably the greatest single leap of all pre-human evolution was executed when the reptile became a bird. The bird types of today, eagles, ducks, pigeons, and ostriches, all descended from the enormous reptiles of long, long ago.
That is a big jump.
Yeah, and they're building up, like I said, to kind of a scientific little statement here. So, these paragraphs are kind of highlighting for the scientists some key issues that we don't need to, expound upon right now. But obviously when they say probably the greatest single leap, they're giving you relativities of, where you have an amazing amount of the whole coming together and leaping forward, and when it's a more minor, they're giving you some sense of the relative significance of this. For if you're going to examine it scientifically, okay, keep going.
The kingdom of reptiles, descended from the frog family, is today represented by four surviving divisions: two non-progressive, snakes and lizards, together with their cousins, alligators and turtles. One partially progressive, the bird family, and the fourth, the ancestors of mammals in the direct line of descent of the human species. But though long departed, the massiveness of the passing reptilia found echo in the elephant and the mastodon, while their peculiar forms were perpetuated in the leaping kangaroos.
A little reminder, seeing those final statements, like I said, with some scientific elements. The key little thing to note there is, you know, them breaking it up into two non-progressive, one partially progressive, and then one obviously very progressive that leads to humans. You might say, well, why? Why is the bird family partially progressive? On every world, the birds have to go all the way to Fandors, which are very fancy animals. Suspicious that that's the deal there. Why that one is partially progressive, right? That line doesn't go all the way to the will creatures, but you know, remember that there are those special animals that are used always on worlds. You have to get Fandors. Yeah, so that's an interesting little tidbit there. That might answer why that is has so, like more potential in it than snakes and lizards and whatnot. Okay.
The end of that paragraph is curious to me because that's one of the questions that people that think about reptiles have: how did they move? Mm-hmm. And you see old movies, they're and there's things, specifically many of them, say all, but many of them leapt like kangaroos, which they should be able to figure out from the mythology.
that's been evolving a lot in recent years. They literally in the museums, tear the dinosaur assemblages the bone assemblages apart and reconstruct them to, it's like, actually I think they were probably more poised like this, or they moved like this, and they keep reworking that,
Jurassic Park.
Yeah. Okay, so this tiny little thing, this next paragraph is what I was hinting that they were coming on.
Only 14 phyla have appeared on Urantia, the fishes being the last, and no new classes have developed since birds and mammals.
Right, so you have phyla, and then the subsets are classes. See, there they're using the official terms.
What's phyla? I'm dumb.
You've got, like all the animals are broken up into subsets.
Okay, those are all phyla.
Called phyla, yeah.
Seventh grade biology.
But it's a very fascinating pair, because remember, this is not the bottom-up discussion of this stuff. This is the top-down discussion of this stuff, right? As we examine the animals and break them up into phyla from the bottom, our bottom-up point of view, we have, more than 30 phyla. But they're saying, if you actually view it more objectively from the top down, from the mind point of view, mind broke animals up into 14 subsets. Right? And you ought to reflect on, the way you break these up into sets more objectively and see if you can see how more fundamentally there's 14, not, 34, 35, 36, whatever the heck you decide there is, 30 plus.
Is it 7 times 2?
No, I mean, who knows, right? If there's some, numbers there, but at least starting out, everyone always goes, they start digging around in biology texts, and it's like, I don't see anyone that says there's 14. I don't know, whoever wrote this doesn't know what they're talking about. It's like, no, it's not the bottom-up thing. Where you're looking at the molecules and going, well, I think these molecules are kind of all the same. Let's call that a phylum. And, top down.
The way they wrote this, it's an open question whether there are still 14.
Right. I mean, you got to look at it over the whole span, yes.
Right. It even seems to contradict itself. Fishes being the last, but then the other two were after the fishes, right? So.
Yeah, but within a phylum. A pre-existing phylum. I mean, the fishes started in a new phylum. Okay. Right? They've got that backbone thing happening.
And birds started a new family. Right?
Yeah. No.
They're in the
backbone. Birds and mammals are in the backbone group. Okay.
One of the things they miss, backbone.
Again, I don't want to get into all the details. I mean, I'm being a little bit fuzzy with it purposely. I don't want to burrow down in all the minutiae of this. Go get your biology text out and or Wikipedia, you know, if you want to burrow into the details here more. All right, keep going.
It was from an agile little reptilian dinosaur of carnivorous habits, but having a comparatively large brain that the placental mammals suddenly sprang. These mammals developed rapidly and in many different ways, not only giving rise to the common modern varieties, but also evolving into marine types, such as whales and seals, and into air navigators, like the bat family.
Okay, so, again, we're still in this kind of hop, skip, and a jump to humans mode here. But they, they wanted to point out, you see what do they highlight? They developed rapidly into many different ways. So there was, as we talked about, you have this diversity. It spreads out all these different flavors of mammals because, of course, it's looking for just that path that takes it up to humans. And you have kind of diversity, an over diversity. They didn't want humans that started, in the water and then ended up on land, or started in the air and ended up on land. They wanted, land. Yeah, but you did end up with, they're reminding you that because they've loosened the constraints here, you had them ending up going into the ocean and going into the air.
But they've indicated on the other planets, right. Sometimes they evolve from sea creatures.
Right, yeah. From flying creatures, navigators. So, they're just reminding you again of the complexity and... some of the diversity that we have here is to a degree superfluous, you might say, because it's an experimental world.
From a carnivore, not an herbivore.
Yeah, carnivorous habits. Again, the anthropomorphic way of talking about it, right? Because they are your ancestors, great 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 granddaddy.
Man thus evolved from the higher mammals, derived principally from the Western implantation of life in the ancient east-west sheltered seas. The eastern and central groups of living organisms were early progressing favorably toward the attainment of pre-human levels of animal existence. But as the ages passed, the eastern focus of life emplacement failed to attain a satisfactory level of intelligent pre-human status, having suffered such repeated and irretrievable losses of its highest types of germplasm that it was forever shorn of the power to rehabilitate human potentialities.
Okay, and as they finish up this section, they're transitioning into section three that we won't get to this evening, but the way they're talking about it, rehabilitate human potentialities, the bringing into existence of potentials in the animals. Okay, and that to think of that literally, and that. This Eastern group lost that. There was no way that the over-control of mind could restore those lost potentialities. So it just becomes a dead-end phenomenon towards the primary goal of getting will creatures. And they have to fiddle around a little bit to deal with that issue. So that it doesn't get fed in and in a back mating kind of a mode and drag things down.
Lost it by something getting killed.
Well, yeah, just like they said there. See, there was so many losses, of the higher genetic types that, you remember how this goes. They're going to remind you, that you had the Western coming over and combining with the Central a little bit and the Eastern being avoided. Okay.
Since the quality of the mind capacity for development in this Eastern group was so definitely inferior to that of the other two groups, the life carriers, with the consent of their superiors, so manipulated the environment as further to circumscribe these inferior prehuman strains of evolving life. To all outward appearances, the elimination of these inferior groups of creatures was accidental, but in reality, it was altogether purposeful.
Yeah. And notice that it sounds like this was kind of more than the run of the mill sort of thing that they had sort of standing permission for. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That they actually had to say, oh, well, we have kind of a different sort of a situation here. Do we have permission to intervene a little bit more than we normally do? And the answer was yes. And so they did. And they were eliminated. Now, I probably don't have to take you out of all oh so long ago and remind you of the parallel there, right? Of, if you end up being part of a phenomenon on this planet that is a fundamental drag on the ability for this planet to get to light and life, don't be surprised if your group, it seems to be completely natural, but it's nonetheless purposeful that you're eliminated. Okay? And remember, they even tell you at one point that the secondary midwares will participate in such activities, seeing to it that groups that are a real fundamental problem, no matter how spiritual they might think they are and progressive they might think they are, they're problematic, and they will just not be as effective as they were hoping in fade from time.
So the life carriers don't step in again.
No, the life carriers don't. But there are instances. They remind you that it isn't totally hands off. If there needs to be some circumscribing of effectiveness of certain political or movements or whatnot, they will coincidentally just not quite work out. No, it won't seem like anyone intervened, in any overt way, but it just doesn't work out. Right. They're reminding you that they're very clever about this. They do it as quote-unquote naturally as possible, but it is nonetheless unnatural, purposeful. Personality management is given permission to be a little bit more intervening than normal. Yeah. If you're interested, do some searching and find that little passage about the secondary midwares being given permission occasionally to do such things. All right, let's keep going here so we can finish up.
Yeah. Later in the evolutionary unfolding of intelligence, the lemur ancestors of the human species were far more advanced in North America than in other regions, and they were therefore led to migrate from the arena of Western life implantation over the Bering Land Bridge and down the coast to southwestern Asia, where they continued to evolve and to benefit by the addition of certain strains of the Central Life Group. Man thus evolved out of certain Western and Central Life strains, but in the central to near eastern regions.
Again, they're telling a story, but see how they're teeing up the fostering of evolutions in the next section. So we don't need to dwell too much on it, but just, they're reminding you of they were therefore led. They didn't just coincidentally migrate, right? There was personality management there. Very definitively. Okay, and then wrap it up here.
In this way, the life that was planted on Urantia evolved until the Ice Age, when man himself first appeared and began his eventful planetary career. And this appearance of primitive man on Earth during the Ice Age was not just an accident. It was by design. The rigors and climatic severity of the glacial era were in every way adapted to the purpose of fostering the production of a hardy type of human being with tremendous survival endowment.
And here it is again. Recall how the previous, the preceding paper ended. Remember that final little paragraph they stuck on the end of the preceding paper, where they were basically being nostalgic about the old days when we weren't such wimps.
Oh, right.
To sum it up bluntly.
Yeah.
Right. So again, again, very specifically, reminding us how that it's by design that we came into human status in the midst of the Ice Age, for the cattle prod that is, and then put the two together. So they're saying, you guys are getting kind of wimpy. You need a lot of safe spaces.
You're supposed to be
vertebrate. You don't suppose there might be, just coincidentally, something in the design where there'll be more rigorous environment coming up to strengthen you up a little bit? It'll appear to be natural, or it may even appear that you did it to yourself, but it's all part of the grand plan. Okay.
Coastline property. That's right.
See, that's the important thing. I mean, and we don't need to, we don't want to, it's getting late, so we don't want to go on too much with this. But just, that's it. That's the kind of stuff, that kind of synthetic recognition that I just did there. Put that together with how that preceding paper ended. It's like, oh, yes, okay. Recognize what they're saying between the lines. I mean, remember, there's a vast conspiracy, right? If we don't choose to, if we don't get more rigorous by choice, there will be, the vast conspiracy will make us more rigorous again, right? So if you don't like the idea of a very, very harsh life, right, in the first two developmental epochs, right, you need to choose. It's all about, as they go through this section, they take you through the whole evolutionary process. It's all about that mind over control of matter. But at the end, personality starts coming in addition. It's not just mind over control, but more and more there's personality over control. First in the hands of the life carriers, and as they tell you in the next section, but then it's handed off to us. Right? See, so that's, it goes from just single-celled plants, right, to personality managed. That's the panorama they just swept you through there. And you do the same thing. You start as the single-celled organism, and then you need to eventually become an adult of God and be personality managed.
With a mind.
Yes, through mind. Right. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.